This podcast is brought to you by Amusement Warehouse Magazine, the industry's largest trade publication. We cover amusement parks, carnivals, fairs, festivals, history, safety columns. We really got it all when it comes to the amusement business. Only remaining print publication in the amusement industry on a regular basis. So if you're interested in what the amusement industry has to offer, subscribe today. You can subscribe by logging on to amusementwarehouse.com, carnivalwarehouse.com, or amusementparkwarehouse.com. Welcome to another edition of the Amusement Warehouse Podcast. Today from Texas, we have Nate Janicek with us. I think Nate's our first pure concessionaire. I mean, we had Steve Iani, but he does some other things as well. But welcome to the podcast, Nate. We're glad to have you.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
It's great. You're just getting ready to start your season, I guess, this year, huh?
We are. Yeah. We're actually right now, we're got a lot of work going on at my shop here. Getting ready for Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo.
That's a pretty big one. You got to get ready for it.
Yeah. Yeah. Lots of projects going out there, painting and fixing and repairing and building, and a lot of cool stuff going on right now.
That's great. So tell us about how you got started in the business, what your history is. I don't know it myself. Usually I do some research, but it's hard to research guys that are concessionaires at carnivals are a little easier, but how'd you decide to make a life of traveling around and selling hot dogs to people?
Yeah, it was.
I'm being facetious, of course, but you sell more than hot dogs. But
yeah, but we love selling hot dogs, so we're happy. We'll take it. In 2006, I graduated college, and
where'd you go?
I majored in philosophy and theology.
Nice, I did too.
Yeah,
My daughter majored in philosophy. That's funny.
Yeah, so
I was a religion major, religion and government, and my daughter was a philosophy. We're both in the same business as you are. It must be a popular major.
This is where all the philosophers go.
Where'd you go to school?
Augustana. It's a small school in Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
Okay.
So yeah, I graduated and I went out with my philosophy degree and all my vast knowledge, and I got a job. After, you know, interviews and stuff, I accepted a job as a managing a franchise of fast food restaurants. It seemed to be my best option at the time. And after a few months of that, I wasn't really feeling like that's what I wanted to do with my life. So I went on a road trip, as people at that age do. I don't know why. I went on a road trip and I went camping, backpacking in Yellowstone and stuff. And I ran out of money and I was taking the Greyhound bus back home to Nebraska. And I met some guys on the bus who were like kind of interesting characters. And they told me they were going to a carnival in Denver and that I should come join the carnival. And they said, oh, you went to college. They'll for sure give you a job. You could be an electrician. We know the guy who's the electrician. So I said, okay. So I spent my like last 30 bucks on a cab ride to the dog track in Commerce City, Colorado, which is like right outside of Denver. And I went up there and I asked for a job. And I did talk to the guy who was an electrician. His name was Doug Barton. He owns Pride of Texas shows now.
Yeah, yeah.
And Doug gave me a job. And I worked for his wife, Christy, and him.
As an electrician?
I mean, in the carnival, if you're an electrician, you pull a lot of heavy wires. At the time, I was young and I had a strong back, and
so you applied for a mule job.
Challenge of it. So yeah, I was an electrician, but I learned a lot.
You had different philosophy classes than I did. They taught you like electricity.
I learned a lot from Doug Barton, though, and truly, Doug is a great guy. His dad was a guy named J.B. Barton who was electrician of the Bill Hames shows for a lot of years. And they really do know a lot about generators and carnival electricity stuff with the rides and all the equipment that goes into transferring the electricity to the rides and the games and the food stands. So, but most of the time I worked setting up and tearing down the rides, working as a ride attendant. I worked in their food stands a little bit. And in the course of that, I met a guy who was like childhood friends with a guy who was my friend from college. It was on the same show. He owned all the concessions on the show. And so a little while later, toward the end of that season, or at the end of the season, I ended up working for him. And I worked for those guys for a few years, from 2006 till about 2009 or 10. I worked for Jason and Matt Kruger, learning the concessions business. I ended up managing all their food stands. But I got to a point where I wanted to do what I saw my friends back home doing, which was like starting to buy homes and get married and like settle down. And I didn't feel like I was going to find the right partner on the road. I met a lot of lovely people, young ladies in different towns and different places and stuff, but none of them were fit that idea for me. So I went home and I was managing a family fun center. And that's when I started. I had met my wife, my wife, Stephanie. I had met her while I was on the road, but when I got off the road, we started talking and we started dating long distance. And ultimately that's what brought me back on the road was my relationship with her. We decided to go down life's path together. And the family fun center was kind of seasonal because Omaha, it gets cold and it snows and stuff.
Yeah.
So it was getting to be that shutdown time around Labor Day, and she was getting ready to play the Minnesota State Fair. And so.
Oh, she was from the business.
Yeah. Stephanie Vandervoorst. Her dad is Steve Vandervoorst. His father just went into the SLA Hall of Fame. They've owned roller coasters and been heavily involved in the equipment industry for a lot of years. So
you always had big equipment.
Always moved the big stuff. So I went with Stephanie and we started. She went to college and went into the real world too, and was just kind of decided she wanted to be in the amusement business. So she was just kind of starting up with her stuff. And so we,
where did you meet her exactly though?
I met her at the East Texas State Fair.
Oh, you did? Okay. No, I got confused.
South Texas State Fair. I met her in Beaumont.
Beaumont, Texas. I thought you met her at, when you're doing the FEC thing, I was like, what kind of chance was that to meet Stephanie Vandervoorst at a FEC somewhere? Okay. So you met her on the road. Gotcha.
Yeah. I met her at the fair. She was just starting off with this. She had this little trailer that she had bought from Mr. Phil Sheridan Sr. And she was using it to sort of debut this concept, the Texas Tater Twisted Potatoes on a Stick that she'd come up with.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I met her at that fair. We had like 8 or 10 joints there, Jason did, and so I was running all those joints, and she was booked in, and she didn't really want to have anything to do with me. She was very like focused and like very, very focused on what she was doing, and I was just trying to meet, you know, be a funny guy and stuff. And so that winter, IAPA and IFE were both in Las Vegas at that same time. And so we went there to pick up a pizza stand. And that's when I finally got her to really like talk to me, and we became friends and you know, started communicating over the phone and stuff like that. And over the course of, you know, the next year and a half or 2 years, we started dating and decided to, give it a go together. And that's what we did.
So the whole idea of going back home to find somebody really failed, I guess.
It failed. Yeah, it failed.
You want to meet somebody from on the road anyway.
Yeah. I couldn't be more grateful and happier to have to found her. You know, we kind of found that we really mesh well together. We both have sort of unique interests and unique things that we find funny and interesting, and movies that we liked and stuff like that. So it was
You know,
really
it's funny.
cool.
There might be, and I never thought about this before, but there, even from like people like you, there might be a little bit of a bias against. I mean, it's not terrible bias, but a little bit of a bias against, you know, finding your partner out on the road. You know, you might have a little bit of like a regular person, and you're saying, "Well, I got to get off the road to find the right person." But there, you know, the more you meet people from this industry, the more you're amazed by how diverse and incredible the people are in the industry, you know, out there that, like you're saying with your wife, you probably never knew you'd find a person that had all those varied interests and all those, you know, qualities that you thought you had to go off the road to find, but she was sitting right there on the road with you.
She was right there. And you know, Stephanie's so smart. She graduated from Notre Dame. She majored in business and mathematics. She's such a
Wow.
smart lady. And she recently just graduated with her master's degree from Baylor, just because she felt like doing a person, you know, challenging herself to do something as a personal goal. So she she was right there, and I almost missed it by going off the road. So I'm glad that it worked out the way it did.
That's great. So I guess eventually you guys started your own business. What year was that? Like, where are we now with time?
2011 is when we decided to combine our efforts.
And Stephanie already had some kind of going concern with food stands, right?
She had the Texas Tater Twister, and she had a location in Minnesota. And
Oh, well, just the location in Minnesota.
to be honest with you, we had to work a lot of spots for her parents to be able to financially survive. We went and worked that winter. We went and worked Miami for Steve, and Steve really helped us. He got a stand into Miami for us. We sold Cuban sandwiches at Santa's. And I say we sold Cuban sandwiches. We tried to sell Cuban sandwiches. We mostly fed our help, and then we went to West Palm and worked for Steve there. And we were really trying to build our own route. But throughout that time, my in-laws were really gracious, and they let us be a part of their operation, where we worked the photo booth for the Crazy Mouse roller coaster. And I mean, we sat in that photo booth all day and all night, and down, you know, we sat there open to close in at State Fair of Texas together. And it was fun. You know, we were in like the honeymoon phase of dating, so you know, we could go anywhere and enjoy being together, and we were just happy to be together. So, but yeah, that really allowed us to financially survive. We really didn't have much funding at that time, but we were going to conventions and going to trade shows, and we had all these dreams and all these ideas of stuff we wanted to do together. And I believe it was that next winter that we went to the trade show again in Vegas, and we saw Guy Leavitt on an elevator, and she had the Texas Taters booked into Houston, but we wanted to be like Juicy's. We wanted to be like the big turkey leg barbecue sales. That's what we envisioned for ourselves, and we really looked up to Juicy. So we were in the elevator with Guy, and we choked. We wanted to pitch him, and we went down. You know, we went down to the bottom floor in Bally's, and we were standing there in the casino. And I said, "Oh, we gotta go talk to Guy. We gotta go back up there. We gotta ask him if he'll give us a chance in Houston." And we were both really nervous. I mean, I think my wife might have almost like been emotional about it. Well, we went back up there and we asked Guy if we could have a chance. And he goes, "You know, Guy, I saw the interview you did recently with him, and he's such an amazing person,
Yes.
but he's hard to read." And he goes, "You think you're ready?" And that's what he said to us. And we were like, "Yeah, we're ready. We're ready." And then we got a call that winter that they were going to let us set up a barbecue in Houston. And then that's kind of where things started for us, where we decided we were gonna make it on our own. You know, we were either gonna make it or we weren't, but we were gonna go out and do our own, you know, Stephanie and Nate thing. And that's what started it all for us, was that meeting at it was at the pair at the Bally's upstairs at the where they had the sandwiches and the Showman's League of America stuff.
Yeah, you're right about I don't know Guy well. I've met him a couple times over the years, but I told the story the first time I met him, I was gushing about how great he had, everything looked and everything else. And he said, "Thank you very much." And then he walked away, went to his thing.
You
But
know, he's a man of few words, but with
yes.
him, I find that it's best to hang around and listen for when he does drop little nuggets of wisdom. They're pretty profound, and
Yeah,
he's
I
very,
enjoyed that interview. It was very good. I've always
yeah.
admired the
Him and
show,
his
and
wife
I
are
know
both
all the things he
incredible.
did. It just was I never really got to know him very well. He's a West Coast guy, and I'm mostly East Coast, but I did over the years go to Houston a couple times and go to Phoenix just to see what he was doing, because he a lot of times he was doing great things. So it was always neat. I mean, to go see him in some of those West Coast shows and see what they were doing different than the East Coast shows. I mean, there's some great ones over here too with the Wade shows and the people here that are doing great things. And
Yeah.
but it's nice to see a little diversity of what's going on.
Yeah, they're fantastic folks to work with. And that, you know, the cool thing about Guy and Charlene was that it was very difficult for Stephanie and I to get in certain doors and rooms, because when you are in that position when you're young, and Stephanie being somebody's daughter and me being kind of like the son-in-law. You're always the kids to other people. Oh, the kids, they want to do this, the kids, they want to do that. But Guy and Charlene, they treated us like adults. They treated us like everybody else, and they took us at our word, and they gave us a chance to prove ourselves. And we had some failures, and they were very helpful in mentoring us and advising us, and they didn't just throw us out. You know, we did that barbecue that year, and that opportunity sort of grew to where we eventually got onto the Circle Drive, which is where the action is. And the first big night of selling turkey legs, we fell flat on our faces, and the turkey legs weren't ready. They were frozen, or they were cold, or whatever. And we were sitting there with torches and charcoal and all this stuff, trying to
It's a
heat them.
workout. It's a workhouse selling that turkey legs. It is. That's a
Yeah,
job.
and then pretty soon Guy Lovett's standing there in the stand, and Ben Pickett's there, and they're on. Oh my God, they're gonna run it. They're gonna tell us to leave tomorrow, but they didn't. They called us in and asked us if we learned anything, and that was the last time that we ever at an event didn't have hot product, regardless of the size of the lines or the crowd or anything like that. We've come close, some of these big days in Houston and big days, but never again did we not have hot turkey legs to sell to the hungry customers. So we're grateful that they didn't tell us to pack our stuff up and leave that day.
Get out. So you really took on some big events from the beginning. You it's nice to have the introduction to some of these independent fairs through the Vandervoorst family and Steve, who I'm sure knew a lot of the people, because a lot of people spend a lifetime trying to get the right contacts to get into those places. So it's nice to have a little bit of an entree anyway into those places. But like you said, it's you're ramped right up. You gotta be able to operate big, right? I mean,
Yeah, we
gotta be
had to
ready to
sink or
go.
swim right away. RCS, while they were very, like I said, very gracious to us, but we understood that the expectations were very high. We couldn't go in there and do a mediocre job. And a lot of these other big fairs, Dallas, we eventually got it. It was nice to have an introduction, but we still had a lot of, Dallas rejected us 7 years in a row before they
Wow.
finally found a spot for us. And we had kind of given up on Dallas, but they gave us an opportunity, and it was Rusty was beginning to open up that extreme zone area down where the Magnum is and where the Windstorm roller coaster and all that used to be. That used to just be fenced off right there, and the people would stop there would, but now you know, Rusty opened it up to where it continuously flows around with the whole rest of the fairground. So they, the first year they did that, we had an opportunity there. John Baker at the Pima County Fair, he saw potential in us, and when they were making a change from, they had a vendor that had the big barbecue corner at their fair for 30 years, and they were making a change there, and there was a very competitive bidding process there, and he saw potential in us and gave us opportunity, and we've been there ever since. There have been a few fair managers that have taken a chance on us based on our enthusiasm and our ideas and some of the concepts that we've presented them, and we're very grateful for that.
So getting into those fairs, you got to have a little bit of a different idea, something to attract the attention. You can't just show up and say, "Hey, I have a funnel cake stand," because you probably have a long, long wait, before you ever get in. So, what were your strategies for, getting in there? What were your sort of unique selling points, and how did you differentiate yourself from all the other hordes of people that were trying to get in and do the same thing?
There's a couple ways, and you're exactly right. That was our mission from the start, was how do we differentiate ourselves, because we're not going to get in with cotton candy, we're not going to get in with funnel cakes, we're not going to get in with corn dogs, but we wanted to be in, and we wanted to do things that we were excited about. So we saw ourselves doing products and presenting them in a way that other people weren't doing. And the big one, I think, at first was brisket. We had this really great, and we still have this really great slow cooked. We cook our brisket overnight, we trim it all, and we have our own rub that we rub on it in-house. And we only buy USDA prime beef. So when we present that to our customer, they can tell that our product is different. So it's always been important to us that we have a superior product, that we offer a product that other people aren't offering. I don't know of a lot of guys or companies on the road that are selling sliced brisket. A lot of folks will sell chopped brisket because you can cook the briskets, you can chop it all up, and you can blather a bunch of sauce together with it, and you can make kind of like a loose meat sandwich, and you can fake your way through it. But to really do brisket in Texas at the Houston Rodeo of all places,
Yeah, really.
you've got to have a product that is authentic. It's got to have the smoke ring, it's got to have the flavor, it's got to have the tenderness. It's a process. We don't smoke any of our briskets for less than 15 hours. We monitor the temperature really closely overnight. We use specific kind of wood. We're able to age the wood now at our ranch over here in Seguin. So all the wood we use is, we let it set for a year, then we use the wood. So that was one way, was the product being a point of difference. But then as we tried to grow, we started creating stands and concepts that we saw that other people weren't doing. We built a baked potato stand. We took these giant baked potatoes and we filled them with all kinds of different ingredients, like grilled chicken and homemade macaroni and cheese and pulled pork. Things that I've always said, the products we sell, we try to sell things that are authentic to, like, to what we're interested in. Like, if you came to a barbecue or a party at our house, we would want to feel like we're serving that same type of food to our customers. When friends come and visit us at the fair, like at Cheyenne Frontier Days, where we have all the food locations, I don't say, well, hey, go out there and, but don't go to this stand, don't go to that stand, and don't go to that stand because that corn dog sucks. And I'm pretty proud of all the products we sell. We really work hard on sourcing the best beef, the best chicken, the best hot dogs, the best produce. We generally only deal with bakeries that bring us fresh bread every day. For my hamburgers now, I'm working directly with a rancher who owns the cattle. He owns the feedlot and the packaging operation. So we're getting a real farm to table. We're selling the same burgers that a lot of restaurants in San Diego are selling in these like higher end steakhouses. And it's expensive, but it's what makes our product different. We're not interested in just the quick sale. and hey, we'll get their money right now. We're really trying to build repeat business because we weren't always in the greatest locations. We asked for these opportunities and we say, hey, just put us anywhere and we'll build it up. And that's kind of what we've done at a lot of places. We've built up some of these middle locations off of some of these items that you can't, that our customers know they can't get elsewhere at on the property.
Yeah, that's got to be difficult though. You said you had USDA prime brisket and but you know, getting that message to the customer so they really understand it, because you know, most people are walking around and they're saying, "Ugh, all these stands are the same. They're just a bunch of carnival guys throwing some things out there." And first of all, just getting the message across and having them believe it. I mean, I was around a show for a long time. The guy used to put all these trophies out that he won this award, won that award. Yeah. And I asked him one time, he's like, "Oh, I just bought them at the store."
You know? Yeah, yeah. We've known some people like that too. Well, they'll put award winning on their stand or
award winning giant trophies and all that stuff. And, you know, but to actually have prime beef, you know, you must advertise it on your stand or how do you get that message to the customer that's just flopping around looking for a sandwich, you know, and why is it worth it to spend probably a little bit more, I would imagine, since you're selling prime for that. And why is, you know, the farm to table important, and does it translate into more business?
Yeah, that's great. Great question. I do think it translates to more business, and the way we're able to accomplish that is through the branding. You know, like I was saying earlier, we really looked up to Brett Enright, the guy who owns Juicy's. We always thought that he was such an innovator with branding. You know, the way that McDonald's has branded themselves, or some of these other household names. So we really honed in on working with graphic designers and people that maybe weren't from the industry. We work with more of a mainstream graphic design team that helps us with our branding and our PR and stuff like that. So in our branding and in our band, and you know, in every fair, like Houston's coming up, I've got a truckload of banners that are probably good enough for Houston. I've probably got some signs and I've probably got menus that are good enough. But I'll have all new menus, I'll have all new signs, I'll have all new stuff on just that we think communicates that message about quality. We put on our banners fresh, never frozen, locally sourced, farm fresh, things like that. And then with that, we try to work really closely with the PR teams at these different events to get on the news, to get on the morning media, to get on social media, to enter all the food competitions that they have, so that we can get that message out there.
That's smart, because the PR people are looking for stories, and a lot of times the food. I've worked at, you know, several big fairs where either as a consultant or something else, where you know it's like pulling teeth to get the information out of some of the vendors, but it's. If you're coming to them with that message, that's fantastic for them, because they'll eat it up if they're smart anyway. They'll see that there's a value in that story and able to get it out there. Even maybe interviewing the bakery that delivers you the bread, you know, it'd be interesting to hear about, you know, how you know, once a year the fair comes to town and they're supplying Fun Biz and how they gear up for it would be an interesting story, I would imagine.
Yeah, and we do that. Like in Cheyenne, we've become friends with some of the local news anchors. They text and we'll be texting and calling months in advance of the rodeo. They want to know what we're bringing new this year. And I mean, I've done segments with them where we walk around for 3 or 4 minutes and we show them inside the prep kitchens. We'll have the news anchor making funnel cakes, dipping corn dogs. But all that is really, it's important to have those relationships and to really work on that every year. And realizing that we're a carnival concessions company, we're not a PR company, we're not web designers, we're not social media experts, but there are people out there who are, and we have sought those people out, and we have a full-time social media marketing guy, Alex, who's done a ton of stuff for Game of Thrones and Mountain Dew, and just no social media. And, you know, so I see a lot of folks in our industry want to do social media, and they've got all the people on their show like and comment on their posts, but they're not really reaching anybody outside.
No, they're very insular.
Circle.
Yeah. They're very insular. They post and they get reaction from, work or like a Carnival's do it too, because we do some social media for things, and they'll go to me even like, well, I liked your post, but I didn't get a lot of reaction from, but you know, then you put up, oh, we just painted our roller coaster, and they'll get like, 100 reactions. And, to get to explain to them that they're just reaching their own followers who are guys that work for them and, industry, people interested in the industry, and it's not moving the ball down towards a goalpost for them is hard, because, it's like an addiction almost. When you get feedback right away, it's addicting, because like, you're like, oh, they're responding to me, and they think you're a star, but you're 100% right with that. Because, and the other thing is, and Matt Cook, my partner with a lot of these things, and I do marketing, he does websites and things, and you get so many people whose, cousin, does a website once or something like that, or on my side, everybody knows how to use Facebook to a certain extent, but to be able to use it for business and to use it for the things you want is a different skill. But, because they say, oh, he's wonderful. He posted a reel the other day and it was great. Oh yeah, it was. That's great. Yeah, he made a website and it was somewhat functional. That's fine, but it's not gonna help you with your business. So it's interesting that you've been, really reaching out to find people who are very good at what they're doing to move your brand and to make a name for yourself.
It's super important, and I'll bet you every big show in America has a guy who's a really good photographer and has a super nice big long lens and has a cool microphone with the fuzzy thing on it and has a drone and does all this cool stuff, but isn't getting it out to the people that matter. It's just, I see it, and I'm a member of the Facebook group or whatever, but we have gone and we think done that differently. We don't know what we don't know. We're not, like you touched on it, the economy of social media. There's a whole economy there. There's a whole way to monetize that and to place value on that and to really like make that a value to your business. But the way to do that is not to just hire your cousin who designed a website a couple times or took some classes at the community college or whatever. It's to engage. And engagement is so important. And the way you engage is with content creators and social media people that have audiences of their own that are massive. And that's what we do. We'll have these, my PR guy has been working all winter on creating these influencer events at all of our different fairs. And we'll bring in influencers and we'll do a special day for them. It might be the day before the fair opens. It might be on a slow Wednesday, but we'll bring in a whole bunch of them. And we don't just say any influencer, like they have to meet certain criteria. They got to have so many hundreds of thousands of followers. And in the LA market, sometimes it's got to be like a lot of followers because everybody, in those markets has 100,000. So we got to say, well, 300 or 500,000 or more. And sometimes we'll get folks with millions of followers, and then we call them in, we do these events, we give them specific hashtags that we want them to use so that we can track that and create actual reports. And we give them a unique experience. We give them access to all of the new foods and behind the scenes stuff. And we get them into the fair and then we'll partner with RCS and get them in playing games and riding rides. And now that, that's kind of been the next step for us is offering that to we only work with our, as far as carnivals go, we only work with RCS. So offering that to RCS to be a small part of their larger, they have an amazing PR team that they've hired. And so just kind of help trying to be team players there and offer that to them.
Yeah, the technology, I've been experimenting lately. I never thought I was going to get into this topic with you, but with, on the marketing side of things that I do, because everything's digital now, you know, not just social media, obviously, but display ads, streaming TV, you know, whereas you used to buy cable, you used to buy broadcast, you used to buy all those things. It's, you know, it's just not what it used to be. So you have this great medium where you're using digital and getting information. But, you know, now with AI and with cell phone data, we're able to get so much information to enhance what we're doing with advertising. So I've been working with a lot of fairs and a lot of my clients where I might even do the top 50 list this year, where I can use cell phone data to actually tell me how many people came to the fair. And it's pretty darn accurate. I've been testing it against certain things. I mean, the AI fills it in a little bit because, you know, it's not, kids don't have cell phones and things like that. So there's, you know, some segment that you're not getting, but it's a tremendous number. But you can see where people came from, what the demographics are, you know, does it change on certain days with promotions? But I'm also curious about, like, watching traffic on the fairgrounds. Like, how can we track that cell phone data to see how a person comes in and what their route might be? Like, yes. Could I geofence Fun Biz's location on the fairgrounds during that week and see how people came through or what the demographic is of the people that are coming to you? You know, those things are fascinating because, you know, sometimes you have too much information or you don't do the right things with the information you have. But if you can get the information and draw some decent conclusions from it, it's scary almost how you know, precise you could be about things.
It's tremendous. And I think that's something like Disney, like you're talking about having too much information. I mean, that's just all based on your capability to analyze and extrapolate from the information. And that just costs money. So like you see like a Disney, you come in, you buy the Magic Band, and they do. They track all that stuff around based on where you scan the Magic Band and your physical movements around the park. But Disney has a tremendous amount of money to then examine that and draw conclusions and to create, you know, promotions and stuff based off of that. But I think I suspect Disney uses a lot of artificial intelligence and sure, powerful computing for their analytics. And I've always really been curious about that because we're big. I've got three little kids, 10, 6, and 3, and we're blessed to be able to play the fairs. We play right around Southern California and stuff. We spend a lot of time at Disney just kind of doing research, you know.
They probably know more about your kids than you do. It's a little scary.
Yeah. But, you know, it's really interesting to see how it's handled at different levels, you know.
And that's where I think, too, that the expertise comes in a little bit because, like, I was working with some of the people that had data from Placer AI and things, and they were, you know, drawing conclusions from some of the data, but, you know, a couple of the points, and I'm trying to think of some specifics, but I could see that they were making a mistake with their conclusion. Mm-hmm. Because whatever knowledge I happen to have, which isn't much, but whatever I did, I said, you know, no, it's not because of that. It's because of this, I think. And you know, I think my conclusion was more sound. Like I was looking at an amusement park and there were so many, we were trying to see where people came from at different months, you know, if was more local during certain times of the year. And there was a big amount of people coming from the real local area that they were saying they were drawing some conclusion. But then we dug down. It was hotels they were coming from. So they were just tracking the people coming from hotels,
right,
which was great, but it didn't really help what they were doing. But then we dug deeper and we said, you know, we can use this data from the hotels and actually find out which hotels referred the most people to the amusement park, you know, which ones were the biggest funnel to come in. And then, you know, do partnerships with those hotels to say, look, you have a giant number of people coming to our amusement park. Let's do a partnership or let's work together on certain things. But, you know, it's just unlimited what you can kind of do. And it's tremendous that you're using, you know, you want to say a food stand, like it's just a thing on the grounds. But, you know, you're writing at large. You're saying, you know, I can use these tools to impact my business, which is pretty tremendous.
Well, and you can affect your layout too. Like again, you know, we try to farm out the things we're not good at. So like for events where we have to create layouts and create the different things, we use an architectural firm out of Minneapolis, Minnesota. And one of the things that we're looking at doing this year is a traffic study at some of our locations of how they flow through some of these areas, and what affects that traffic flow. Just like they would do for actual vehicle traffic, we can do that on fairgrounds. It's a matter of setting, spending the money and having them come in and set up the equipment and then extrapolating the data. But I think there's a lot of value in that, because it can be the difference between people blowing by you or not even coming down that row, or having them lined up all day and sitting at your tables and enjoying themselves and doing different things like that. So,
That could even help you with something as basic as how your sign faces. You know, if it's the wrong angle,
where the
people are blowing
counters
by you,
go.
like you're saying.
Yeah, where they line up to place the order, where the sign is, so that they can, so they even know that they may be looking for a food stand. They might completely miss you, because the customer doesn't look at the fairground the way we look at the fairground.
No.
It's totally different for them.
It's like you're buying a billboard and they take these great shots, no matter where the billboard is. They say, oh, here's what it looks like. And then you actually go there. And there's like 10 trees hiding the thing. And yeah, if you happen to turn your head just at the right time,
You may
that
have driven by
photo
it
of
100
the
times and
billboard
never
is what you
seen
see,
it.
but that's not what most people see. So.
So just trying to understand, I think, that we don't know what we don't know, and trying to be smarter about that stuff, and to try to hire the right people to get that information for us.
But seeing the value in it is what's important, because most people, I think on some level, they know that those things are important, but they're not willing to say, ah, I can just wing it and I'll be fine. But you really seem to be there's certain people in this business that really do are curious, or they're invested to try and do the right thing. You say Red Kamik shows and guys like that, and they really do want to go to the next level. It's fascinating that, coming from a guy who operates a food business, that you're so invested in those sorts of things, because that's and it's paid off. That's the one thing I wanted to get into is, too, you're doing these sort of I don't want to say food courts, because that's kind of the old word for it, but you're doing these destination spots now at some of these bigger events. I wanted to make sure I touched on that. So
That's a
how'd
great
you
way
get
to
into that, and
describe
what are you doing?
I think that's how I would describe what we do. That's maybe a little different than the traditional concessions company. We think we're kind of in a different lane there. We're not trying to go into the fair and just compete for a funnel cake location or compete for some place to put our trailer. The trailers are great, but I look at the trailer as a tool, not necessarily as the destination itself. And so how we got into that was, that's kind of something we've always done. But more so recently was in Minnesota. We went to them with a proposal to create a permanent Texas barbecue location. This has been a few years ago now. But we put together this whole proposal. We had blueprints and we had 3D renderings and we had all these ideas. And the fair was, really impressed with it, but they said, no thanks. Not only do we not want to give you that real estate, we have other plans for it, which, that's their prerogative. And we don't want a Texas anything permanent on our fairgrounds. We're the Minnesota State Fair. But we have this old building, this pet center over here on the north end. And at the time there was nothing on the north end. It was like a dead end. But they sort of shared their vision with us and where they were going to be investing and how they were going to grow that area. And they wanted to see if we could fit into that vision. So we went back to the drawing board with those same graphic design folks and the same architects. And in partnership with the fair, we were able to have access to the State Fair archives, and we were able to do a lot of research on that building and find out that it had one time, well, it was built in the 1920s. It had been an airplane hangar during the sort of the infancy of air travel in America. They were trying to get the word out to these rural, Americans, farmers, and people that lived in sort of these rural areas, that you can get in these big metal birds and you can fly from one place to the other. And so they had this big hangar that they had built at the fair, and they had airplanes on display there, and they had wing walker shows, and they had all kinds of cool stuff they did aviation related. And so that's where we grew the idea from. But we wanted to create an area for at that time we were trying to create a neighborhood up there. You know, the north end of the fairgrounds, we always call it, when we talk to our friends at the management of the state fair, when we talk to Pam Simons and we talk to those folks, we always talk about the neighborhood. The north end is our neighborhood. And what is, you know, we have a place for people to go get food and drinks, but we also have a place for them to sit down. We have a place for their kids to be entertained. We set up games. We've invested in the landscaping. We have all kinds of different picnic tables and cocktail tables and stand tables and umbrellas. And we have a stage, and we hire and promote the live entertainment there from open to close every day. We have live entertainment, and that's again, that's an expense that maybe some concessionaires will look at and say, you're just throwing money away. You don't, they would still come to you. You're at the Minnesota State Fair. You don't have to do that.
Yeah.
And you know, maybe they're right, but it's not all about the money for us. It's about creating these destinations, like you said. And so that's what we've really tried to focus on at a lot of these events. And that's how we've been given a lot of opportunities. I think offered a lot of these opportunities in the last few years is by being known as the people that do these destinations. When they have an area at a fair where they want to create a destination, I like to think we're the people they contact. And that's kind of been the case. Like even this last year in Dallas, they were ready to tear down the Wave Rider, which they had for the Summer Midway, and they wanted to create a destination there. And they had some like parameters. They wanted it to have sort of a 1936 Centennial Midway Art Deco-y kind of vibe, but they wanted it to be a destination. And we went back, you know, we went to the drawing board and we kind of did what we always do. And we put in artificial turf and we bought a giant 20-foot LED, state-of-the-art, high-definition LED video wall so we could play movies and shows and football and stuff like that. And we took the trailers and we hid the trailers. We put four trailers in there, but we hid them so that we could create this sort of cohesive, branded, like themed area where it didn't look so much like just food trailers. And you don't see the food trailers at all, because we wanted to create this neighborhood feel. And in your neighborhood, you go to restaurants, you know, you have your neighborhood restaurant, you have your hangout, and that's kind of what we try to create. We have these areas that we call, like we've called another area, we call it the backyard. And we try to create a very backyard vibe there. We've got a stage again with live entertainment. And then in Cheyenne, we've tried to create lots of these areas for our customers to go and to be able to enjoy their food and their drinks while their children are able to play, but they're able to still keep an eye on their kids, be entertained by music or video elements and different things like that. So I think it's very important that for us, you know, we are a concessions company, but I like to think that we're an experience brand. You know, we're an experience company. We're primarily concerned with the customer's experience. Our primary concern isn't extracting the customer's money for them as fast as possible and as cheaply as possible, but it's to give them the best experience year after year, so that not only do they come back and continue to come back to us, that the fairs see us more as a partner, like they do with the carnivals. You know, you see like what carnivals do is they co-invest in fairgrounds, they co-invest in capital improvement projects, and that's something that we have focused on pretty heavily in the last decade, is co-investing. You know, if like our food court we were going to set up in Cheyenne, the pavement upon which it was set to go on was in terrible shape, and so partner, you know, utilizing the rodeo's contacts, have people on their committees and stuff that own construction companies and that have worked with, like, you know, some of these contractors in town where we could get a good price on asphalt. We asphalted the whole parking lot, and we think that enhances the customer experience, because now they're not tripping and falling. And, you know, when you're on really crummy old concrete where it's all starting to turn into gravel. You trip and fall, and then you get like little rocks and pebbles stuck in your knee or in the palm of your hand, and that blows. That sucks.
Yeah.
So, stuff like that
It's funny,
where.
you're making me think like it's kind of come around to an extent because I'm always fascinated with how things are ever new in a certain way. And you know, I run a fair in New York as well, and we used to have these areas like there, but they were ethnic. So there was like an Italian area. And it was like, you know, you're kind of describing, there was all kinds of Italian food. They'd have a, you know, Frank Sinatra singer out there with at a stage and all those things. And they had several of these areas. And I know a lot of big fairs are the same way. They used to have these sort of destination areas, but a lot of it was tied to ethnic foods, ethnic things. And
Yeah.
you know, you've kind of you're doing the same thing, but not the, you know, it's a different twist on it. Obviously, it's not you know, tied to an ethnicity or something like that, but you're doing a destination thing. And it's great for the fair because it provides entertainment. It provides a destination for your guests, another thing to do, another area to go to that makes the fair cool. And you know, that's really neat because you're filling so many holes, so many voids that really add to the fair, which is neat. But it is kind of a recycling of a thing that used to be really popular at one time that's kind of gone away.
I mean, I agree with you. Like when I when we think about like our model for the way we do business, I used to hear these stories about these big concessionaires, you know, like the Jerry Ayton. They talk about how Jerry Ayton and Phil Sheridan, they used to have all the food locations at the Indianapolis 500 and all these major events, and they would set up all these food courts and these, they call them like cook shacks, where they'd set up these big tents, and you know, maybe quality wasn't always the focus, but the idea was to get a bunch of people in this area where they could sit down and enjoy the food and have you know, there's another great concessionaires, Pigloot. There's a guy named Craig Sawyer that operates this company out west called Piggly Wiggly. And Guy Livid always tells me about Sawyer's dad, how he had these great condiment stations. And I always think about that. Like, I always tell my folks, we need to have more stuff out there. We need to put out pepperoncini peppers and chopped onions and pickles and olives and all this stuff. Because it helps enhance our customer experience. It helps enhance their enjoyment. And so what if some lady comes by and fills a freaking cup full of pickles, you know, and eats a bunch of pickles? Okay, like that made her day better. That enhanced her customer experience. So we're really, you're right though. I mean, are any like, you know, as philosophy majors, we sometimes wonder, are any ideas really original ideas, you know? Even if you didn't like consciously steal the idea from somebody else, it might just be that it's been done before and it's a good idea, and a good idea is a good idea, and it's okay for two people at different times to have perhaps the same idea and execute it
Who is
similarly.
your favorite philosopher?
Martin Heidegger.
Heidegger.
Yeah. Sein und Zeit, being in time, you know, kind of an interesting guy and lived in an interesting time and had, you know, had an affair with Hannah Arendt, who was a great philosopher. And, you know, she's famous for the theory of the banality of evil and that whole putting all those Nazis on trial and stuff. And her, you know, she was a Jewish woman and famous, like, you know, became a professor in Chicago for a lot of years, tenured, and just a really brilliant lady. But yeah, I really like Heidegger, but also, you know, Thomas Aquinas. I'm
Yes,
Catholic.
there's my favorite.
Yeah, I mean, I'm Catholic, and I've always, my advisor in college got his PhD from Notre Dame and was heavily influenced by Socrates, of course, and Thomas Aquinas. So, you know, you're
The dumb
influenced
ox.
by your mentors.
The dumb ox.
Thomas Aquinas is cool, you know. And my 10-year-old, they go to Catholic school, and she'll come home and she'll have all these questions. She's starting to like be very philosophical, and my
Say,
wife
you hand her the
asks her
Summa,
what's
you hand
that.
her the Summa, and you say, "Let me through.
Yeah,
Okay,
right.
they're here."
End of the Summa. We have it on the bookshelf. We do have it. And you know, they've touched on in her school, they've touched on St. Augustine a little bit, you know. So they're starting down that path, which is cool. It's interesting
I
stuff.
like Augustine, although I didn't love his philosophy all the time. I like things a little more precise, like
Yeah,
Aquinas and
I like
Aristotle.
him though. You know, he's honest about himself. You know, he had a pretty fair estimation of his own like imperfections and stuff.
He was an interesting guy, no
Super
question.
interesting guy.
A
Lot of
lot
them are
of people. Did you
interesting.
like do you like all the German philosophers or just
Yeah, I mean, no, but I like no, I don't like
Zinke?
Karl Marx. I'm not into the Marxist stuff. But I did like what's his name? The guy, he was a mathematician, Kant, right? Immanuel
Kant,
Kant.
Immanuel Kant, yeah.
Yeah, you know that sort of that ontological sort of theory of his, where everything sort of flows and sort of steps across
It
and
has
up
an
and
end.
across. It progresses. And I think Heidegger studied under Immanuel Kant a little bit, if I'm not mistaken.
The time would work, I think.
Yeah,
I'm a little rusty, but
believe he studied under Kant a little bit. So there was some influence there. Heidegger is very hard to understand. You know, though that's kind of, I like reading Heidegger because you have to read it 5 or 6 times to really even like understand
begin to
what's,
understand it, yeah.
and not that you understand the sentence, but to even understand like what he's trying to say, and then to even to go from there, it's a real mind bender, some of the stuff, but I really enjoy it. Well, I don't have a lot of time for that anymore, but you know.
I wonder what the people listening are thinking. Like, what are these two
Oh
crazy people talking
yeah.
about?
Go read Martin Heidegger, Being in Time. Sein und Zeit in German.
Deutsch. That's
Yeah.
great. So what's next for FunBiz? What do you got coming down the pike? You're gonna do more of these destination things? Is that the way to
Yeah.
go? Is that the
We're gonna keep going with the destinations. We're working on a really cool one right now for Del Mar. It'll be open this year, 2025. It's going to be inside of a building. It's we're creating some food concepts where it's more elevated fare, more elevated cuisine, where we're layering flavors and textures and things. We're gonna have some beverages with more floral elements. We're gonna focus as far as the food we're creating for the stand. We've got some textural stuff. We've got some things that'll excite your senses, though, from sight, smell, the texture of it. We're incorporating some raclette cheese onto some of these items at this new fare stand for Del Mar, which raclette, you know, they take this big apparatus and they put this hard cheese on it, and the flame sort of shoots down and melts the top layer of cheese. And you take a sharp blade and you scrape that top melted layer off onto the. For us, it'll be onto a sandwich. So that's an area that we're focusing on. We bought this really cool video screen last year for the new area in Dallas, and I'm excited that we're bringing that to Houston this year, and we're going to have that sort of as an element for our customers. And we're creating some really nice seating areas in Houston this year. We went, I sent my in-laws antiquing this winter to get some really cool sort of Texas-y antique looking stuff to create these really just really fun like seating element. Like we're gonna have seating, but then the decoration of it, we're gonna have flowers and these antiques and music playing, and we're bringing in some wooden tables to have more of a sort of a Texas barbecue feel. And we're investing heavily in these seating areas because that was one of the some of the feedback we got from RCS at one of our last meetings with them of what, you know, areas they'd like to see us improving. And Mrs. Levitt said she'd really like to see us have some super super good quality seating areas. Like when we first came on the show and we just had the one barbecue stand, we had this beautiful seating area, and as things have gotten bigger, we haven't focused as heavily on those seating areas. And so we really wanted to hone in on that that feedback from them and focus on that. So we think that this year you're going to see some really nice seating areas from us. This new area in Del Mar, of course.
I'm really hoping to get out to Houston this year. I haven't been in a few years and
Oh yeah.
want to see what's going on there.
It's a great
Believe it or not,
spot.
we've been talking for an hour. We're about to get cut off by the timer here, but
Okay.
it was fascinating. We covered philosophy and marketing and even a little bit about food.
Yeah, you bet.
Thank you so much for coming on, Nate. It was a pleasure, and hopefully I'll get out to Houston and get to see you out there.
If you do, text me and I'll give you the
Will
grand
do.
tour.
Will do. Grand tour to parking lot that they turn into a fair.
It turned it into an incredible fair, you bet.
All right, sir. Thank you so much, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right, thank you.
This podcast is brought to you by Innovative Ticketing. Is the ticketing source made for the amusement industry. Our staff of professionals can guide you through your setup, assist with customer service, even on the weekends when you most need it, and help increase your sales through promotions that work. Innovative Ticketing is the ticketing source made for the amusement industry. Sign up today at innovativeticketing.com.